It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Census estimates show Pittsburgh's black residents are leaving the city faster than any other demographic. City leaders acknowledge there's a problem, but say they aren't sure what to do. Our next guest says at least some of the onus is on journalists. Public Source and City Paper are hosting a panel of media professionals Wednesday at the August Wilson African American Cultural Center to talk about how bias, erasure, and quality of life are reflected in how media outlets cover communities of color. Joining us to talk about this is Latrell Crittenden, a journalist and an assistant professor of communications at Thomas Jefferson University. He'll be one of the panelists. He's on the line from Philadelphia. Welcome, Latrell.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am well, sir, and I hope you are as well. Latrell, you authored a study of Pittsburgh's media scene last year called The Pittsburgh Problem. How much of the problem is that our newsrooms do not reflect the diversity of our community?
I think that that's an essential problem, but I think that when you look at issues as they pertain to diversity, that's only one of the problems. Certainly, newsrooms in Pittsburgh are not reflective of diversity on a whole in cities. Most recent census that we did with Pittsburgh Black Media Federation concluded that newsrooms were about 10% of color. However, the city itself is about 30% of color. So that lack of diversity inside of newsrooms is key. However, what my study also revealed was that many journalists of color, specifically African-American journalists, do not feel that they have agency inside of newsrooms, which basically means that they're not listened to. Their concerns, their voices, their ideas about coverage, they're not heard. So on one hand, you certainly need to improve the number of journalists of color inside of newsrooms, specifically at leadership positions. However, you need to make sure that when you are bringing those journalists of color into newsrooms, that they have the freedom to voice their concerns, to pitch ideas, and to basically critique how their newsrooms are covering the African-American community.
So did the journalists feel like they could express honestly their concerns or not?
Many of the journalists did not feel that they could express their concerns. They felt that there would be backlash in terms of promotion opportunities. They felt that there would be backlash in terms of the culture inside of the newsroom, that they didn't necessarily have advocates inside of the newsroom that wanted to hear what they had to say. And quite frankly, that tension existed even more with a number of the women of color inside of newsrooms. So that type of agency from the people that we spoke with, no, that did not exist.
You point out we need more representation in our shops, reporters and editors assigning these stories. Those decisions are out of most of our hands. What can we do, all of us in Pittsburgh media, to make changes individually to better reflect the communities of color?
I think there needs to be a strategic plan, quite frankly, to address these types of issues. I'm doing a number of studies in other areas, Chicago, Central Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia. And what I would argue is that the news media ecosystem, or basically the entire media landscape in Pittsburgh, is deficiently behind what other cities are doing, particularly in Philadelphia. So in Philadelphia, you actually have a great deal of collaboration across newsrooms. You have a lot of funding going toward community outlets, community media outlets. I actually help run a community outlet in one neighborhood, an African-American neighborhood here in Philadelphia called the Germantown Info Hub. And you also have a healthy, robust black media where you have multiple media outlets, and you have funding for the local chapter of National Association of Black Journalists. So across the board, you have all these initiatives that are really taking hold to improve how communities of color are being represented. Pittsburgh, you have almost none of that. You basically, Point Park has an initiative, Bridge Pittsburgh, which hopefully will be effective, although we'll see what happens with that. The Pittsburgh Black Media Federation has won two awards, but they're woefully underfunded, specifically from the foundation community. And you have a whole host of freelancers and others who are doing a lot of solid work, but their work is not seen as fruitful enough to earn them positions inside of newsrooms. So you have a number of issues and a number of things that need to happen inside of Pittsburgh that would really transform how coverage actually takes place inside of the city.
Our guest on The Confluence is journalist and professor Latrell Crittenden, who will be speaking at a Pittsburgh Black Media panel Wednesday evening. You're participating on that panel. What can we expect to hear? Journalists as well as the general public, because general public is invited as well.
I think that what you'll hear, because they have a solid group of individuals. You have artists who are active in the media landscape as well as journalists. I think what you'll hear will be, one, that the news media in Pittsburgh need to do a significantly better job of not only covering communities of color, but engaging communities of color. It's one thing to note how often criminals are depicted as African Americans or overrepresented, but it's another thing to talk about the lack of just basic engagement of going into communities and asking, what can we do? How can we better cover you? That's going to be, I think, one of the key things that comes out in that particular panel. And I think also just funding issues. I think that there are a number of individuals who are actually trying to do solid things, but there needs to be a way to figure out how can we fund or better support African American artists specifically and African American journalists who are attempting to do the work of engagement that's not happening currently inside of Pittsburgh.
How are other cities funding that kind of work, other newsrooms?
Foundations. So there are a number of foundations in Philadelphia, Lenfest, Independence Media, that are effectively helping to supplant cuts in reporting in the city. And that has been one key thing. And another thing has been just donations to these efforts. And the thing with Pittsburgh is that that potential exists because, as known, Pittsburgh has a lot of per capita foundation dollars that can go to support journalist initiatives that would cover communities of color. And hopefully that's something that the foundations are taking note of, specifically when you look at places like Philadelphia or Chicago, where there's a lot of foundations, and there can be some sort of intervention that would indeed help fund a lot of the efforts that are geared toward engaging African-American communities in Pittsburgh.
Latrell, you mentioned a key word earlier, collaboration. Media outlets in past years in Pittsburgh have collaborated on special reporting projects, such as veterans issues. But how might a partnership on a continuing basis benefit the overall balanced coverage of minority communities here in the Pittsburgh region?
I would ask anybody to take a look at what Resolve in Philadelphia is doing. Resolve is a collaborative project that involves more than 20 newsrooms, and they've tackled issues such as re-engagement of the incarcerated individuals. They've tackled issues such as housing, which is a significant issue in Pittsburgh as well as it is in Philadelphia. And I think that that serves as a model. But I do think that what you really need to have are discussions that across newsrooms to simply say, well, how can we do X, Y, or Z in order to cover this issue, that issue, and again, better engage communities of color. And I would also really emphasize the fact that you do have one project already, Bridge Pittsburgh, that is attempting to do that. So I would really hope that newsrooms would reach out to them to see if they can collaborate, because that's going to be essential. Keep in mind, Pittsburgh has lost a lot of journalists.
Yes.
So without collaboration, without you're not going to have the same degree of coverage on all issues. But you already have a deficit with communities of color. So that collaboration is key. But again, it also needs to involve Pittsburgh Black Media Federation and Black Media, because those are the individuals who have those connections already to communities of color.
Right. Well, Troy, we have just a minute left. A study released in September by the city's Gender Equity Commission showed a sharp gap regarding the quality of life of whites compared to blacks in Pittsburgh, looking at everything from income to health to education. How do those disparities impact attitudes toward life in Pittsburgh and media coverage? We have just a minute.
I think that you cannot talk about the deficit in news coverage, the deficit inside of newsrooms, without also acknowledging the deficit that people of color have who live in the city of Pittsburgh. That's what I meant by the Pittsburgh problem. One reason that, quite frankly, a lot of journalists of color have left the city is that their quality of life is not very solid in Pittsburgh. So if you're going to overcome a lot of these issues, you have to tackle the larger issue as it pertains to how people of color, specifically African Americans, enjoy their everyday lived experience in the city, which is they're not enjoying it very much.
Right.
Because you can't really deal with diversity without tackling the issue of we need to have people stay in the city.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Latrell Crittenden is a journalist and professor of communications at Thomas Jefferson University. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And he'll take part in a panel conversation Wednesday evening at the August Wilson African American Cultural Center.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, a conversation about improving access to healthcare for regional veterans. And jury deliberations continue today in the trial against a man accused of ambushing a Wilkinsburg backyard barbecue in 2016. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
John Carpenter is best known for his work in the genres of horror and science fiction, but did you know he once directed a movie about Elvis? Starring Kurt Russell in the titular role, Elvis aired on ABC on this day in 1979. The film follows the life and career of the King of Rock and Roll up to 1970, shot in 30 days in over 150 locations. It marked the first time Russell and Carpenter would work together and the last time Russell would act for television. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Every presidential campaign, candidates talk about rural America.
Rural communities are a critical part of any real American success.
To unlock rural communities' potential.
So important to rural America.
Rural America.
But often the day-to-day problems facing less populated parts of the country don't end up in stump speeches. As part of our Embedded 2020 series, Keystone Crossroads' Jen Kinney spent time in rural Schuylkill County, where a volunteer firefighter shortage threatens both tradition and safety.
And let me show you our warning device here. You're in the Sanctum Sanctorum, most holy places of this fire company, right now.
That says get out of the way.
Mike Kitsock has been a volunteer firefighter in Schuylkill County since 1969. He loves it so much, he started a museum.
Pressed tin ceilings, beautiful hardwood floors. It shows the support and the importance that this organization meant for these people.
The ideals of the fire companies are captured in their names. Citizens, Friendship Hook and Ladder Company, Independence, Vigilant, Hope. Today, we're at the Phoenix Fire Company in the town of Shenandoah. It was built after an 1883 fire wiped out 400 houses.
The Phoenix, rising from the ashes and now protecting the community.
Fire companies took on a special importance here in Schuylkill County, where anthracite coal was discovered in 1790. Mining boom towns sprung up, and much of that housing stock still exists today, with wood frame structures that burn easily.
And with them became the need for the fire companies. Not only were they protecting lives and property, but became the social center.
That's still true today. Fire companies are even common polling locations here. Kitsock is devoted to the tradition, but at 66 years old, he didn't expect to still be fighting fires.
Our numbers have depleted so much. We get a daytime call. I'm hoping there's two or three others who show up with me.
All across Pennsylvania and the U.S., most firefighting is done by volunteers, but the ranks are dwindling. Dual-income households, longer working hours, longer commutes have all cut into volunteering time. This leads to longer response times to fires, which could mean more destruction, more loss of life. As in other rural areas, the population here has dropped year after year, driven in part by young people, prime firefighting age, leaving and not coming back. It's a threat to a deeply rooted culture. fire stations as community hubs, sources of pride.
This is my grandson, my daughter-in-law back there, my granddaughter, and my son's right there. So see, it's all family, friends. We've all been members here forever.
Gloria Donati serves pancake breakfast at the Rainbow Hose Company in Schuylkill Haven every other week.
I was raised with it. My dad was a volunteer. My brother was a volunteer. I volunteered for a short amount of time.
Like a lot of local stations, the Rainbow has a social hall and a bar. It's been open for decades. Proceeds help fund the firefighting, like paying for the engines in the bay next door. But as of January 1st, the Rainbow's bar is shut down.
We're going to be open just for fundraising. But other than that, we don't have enough of business to keep it open.
Wealthier townships can pitch in more to their fire stations, making them less reliant on fundraising and volunteers. Some pay professional firefighters to pick up the slack. Schuylkill County and many other rural areas can't afford that. So the state has an unpopular suggestion. Firehouses should merge, blending members and resources. That could mean losing places that used to be, essentially, community living rooms.
Nobody comes around. It's sad. We used to live to hang at the firehouse.
Ace Dussel is still an active volunteer at 71 years old with the Goodwill Fire Company in Pottsville. He opposes consolidation.
And Mike knows Mike's in it.
Oh, my word. It's more to it than just the firefighting end of it. This is part of your existence. And to lose that is so tragic. Mm-hmm.
People here aren't looking for politicians to solve this. What they want is for their friends and neighbors to step up.
I don't know if the younger people today aren't willing to make that commitment.
I am in sketch club, drama club.
Hattie Ebling, a high school senior in Pottsville, is busy but committed. She's following in the footsteps of her dad and brother as a junior firefighter at the American Hose Company No. 4.
You are the puppy of the firehouse.
Her brother Brandon is the first lieutenant here. He sees the fire service aging around him. Recently, he was at a fire with other volunteers.
They're like, look around. You're the youngest guy out of guys that are 40, 50 years old. And one day you're going to be in our shoes. I said, yeah, and I hope to have a younger kid behind me and show him the work.
For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Jen Kinney.
Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 Project is election year coverage that puts people, not politicians, at the center. You can find more at whyy.org/embedded2020. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Innocence or evidence? That's the debate prosecutors and defense attorneys laid at the feet of jurors yesterday as the case against Sherron Shelton moved into deliberations. Shelton is accused of murder and other charges related to the 2016 mass shooting of five people and an unborn child. Here to help us make sense of what comes next, University of Pittsburgh law professor, WESA's legal analyst, David Harris. David, good morning.
Kevin, good to be with you.
David, you're a Pittsburgher. You were in the community when this shooting took place 4 years ago. As you've been following the legal proceedings, what have you been listening for?
Well, of course, it was a horrific crime, and there's a great deal of momentum and a desire to get a crime like this solved, to get the right person. What I've been looking at as time has gone on is how the case seems to have been a very difficult one to assemble on the prosecution side. Of course, as we went into the trial, there were two defendants, and right. As we end the trial, there's only one, because one was dismissed on the first day of trial, something that is almost unheard of. So this case has had its share of ups and downs along the way, which can make for a shaky presentation at trial.
Despite that dismissal of one of the suspects, the charges against that individual, the trial was expected, according to the judge Borkowski, to last 2 to 3 weeks. Instead, it went 6 days. What can we glean from that?
Well, it's hard to know exactly. For one thing, if you do have one defendant dismissed of two, that means the possibility of a defense case from one of the defendants goes away. The cross-examination by that defense lawyer, those all go away. And so there's some time saved there. But my experience is it's actually pretty hard to predict how any one case will go, whether a defense will be put on or not, whether a defendant will testify or not. All of those things are influenced by the actual goings on in the trial itself.
Yeah, and there were more than 50 witnesses, hundreds of pieces of evidence.
That's right.
a lot of contention about DNA.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Part of the evidence, supposedly, found in spit at the scene. It didn't match Shelton, which defense attorneys say means he's innocent. No fingerprints or eyewitnesses either. They did find bullets for a possible weapon, but they weren't the same brand. How difficult is it for prosecutors to rely on a timeline, cell messages to prove guilt?
Well, what you're talking about is a series of circumstantial evidence items being presented. And there's nothing wrong with circumstantial evidence. We hear this sort of all the time when we listen to entertainment, for instance. We always get the phrase, it's just circumstantial evidence. And circumstantial evidence is fine. It's acceptable. You typically need more of it than you would need if the evidence was direct, a confession, for instance.
What rules are the jurors given when considering circumstantial evidence?
Well, the judge would tell them it's just like any other evidence. They're allowed to consider it and draw the inferences that they think it bears. It is not the same as having a witness say, I did this, I saw this, I was there for this, but that doesn't mean that it's any less valuable. You just may need more of it.
The jurors have been asked to consider first and third degree homicide. Remind us, what's the difference?
Well, the difference, or the big difference, is that for first degree murder, there could be a death penalty phase to this trial, whereas with third degree murder, you simply wouldn't have that. Pennsylvania has 3 degrees of murder, unlike a lot of other states, because they allow a second degree murder charge for so-called felony murder. And that allows for people to be locked up, even when they weren't the shooter, for life terms without parole.
The second degree is when another felony is committed, like a bank robbery and somebody.
That's right. It's an unusual creature, but it's a close relative to what you see in other states.
All right. So what happens now?
Well, now the case has gone to the jury. The jury has full charge of the evidence, gets to deliberate. The jury is a black box, so we don't know what happens inside the jury room. Sometimes the jurors will send out notes indicating that they want to see or hear certain pieces of evidence again, want certain pieces of testimony read back to them. But we won't know until we get further along in the deliberations what they do. Their final word is their verdict. That can be guilty. It can be not guilty. It can also be we can't reach a verdict. So all kinds of things are possible at this point. We won't know for a while.
David Harris is a Pitt Law professor, WESA's legal analyst, and he is the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. David, thanks so much.
Kevin, good to be with you.
Deliberations resume this morning in the case against Sharon Shelton. WESA will have more as soon as a verdict is reached. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Ever since an audit about 5 years ago or so showed tens of thousands of veterans across the country were waiting more than 30 days in some cases for an appointment, the Veterans Administration has been taking steps to improve access to care. That includes the VA's online personal health management tool, MyHealthEVet. Joining us in studio are Dr. Jason Fay, manager of the VA Pittsburgh's Office of Connected Care. Dr. Fay, welcome.
Thank you.
Dave White is a coordinator in the MyHealthEVet program. Dave, welcome to you as well.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And Bill Frazier is also coordinator in the MyHealthEVet program. Great to have you with us as well, Bill.
Thank you for having us.
All right. 2 months ago on this program, VA Secretary Robert Wilkie told my Confluence colleague Megan Harris that telemedicine was a top priority to get the VA on the road to becoming a 21st century healthcare institution. How does the overall idea of Connect Care in the Pittsburgh office and the various components here help you get on that road? Dr. Fay, let's start with you.
Yep, sure. Thank you. The Connected Care program is a consolidation of 3 programs recently, the Home Telemonitoring Program, the Clinical Video Telehealth Program, and MyHealthEVet. We aligned them to, under the Chief of Staff system, to prove their efficiency, to market them as a suite of applications. And along with those 3 areas, we also have 45 dedicated apps that veterans can download to their phones to help them provide care for them, the caregiver, and for the provider, the VA.
Bill.
Yeah, so talking about the apps, there are some wonderful applications that the veterans have. Some are web-based, some are iOS, some are Android, some are all. One of the things we have is something called the Annie app, which sends veteran self-care messages. Our GI lab uses that in particular to help veterans get prepped for their upcoming procedures.
Right.
Another one might be for the family member or caregiver, a PTSD family coach, which is iOS and Android. Support and tools for living with someone with PTSD as an example. And healthcare professionals also have apps available, such as Image Viewing Solution.
Okay, Dave?
And what's very surprising here is a lot of folks ask us, well, what are the ages of folks using? Because we're talking internet-based and whatnot, right. Apps. Well, by our stats, by and large, it's like 66% are Vietnam veteran-era veterans.
All right, do the math. How old are we talking about?
So we're talking anywhere from like 65 to 74. So that's pretty amazing. They're very adaptable.
Mm-hmm. And how does the I'm going to say last Friday. We all remember that snowfall that hit last Friday. Worst one of the season. Not that bad, but worst one of the season so far. Schools canceled classes, et cetera. Traffic snarls. How did Connected Care sort of help out in that instance?
Sure. This is Jason again. One of the ways that we were able to do it is through our video VA Video Connect program, which allows a veteran to communicate with their care team through their phone, through an iPad, through their computer. It's a secure method. You could be face-to-face with the provider. You can get all the care needs done, in most cases, virtually.
Mm-hmm. So, Doctor, let me follow up with you on that. So if the appointment was in person, they could reschedule easily, or could they convert that in-person appointment to online, virtual?
Yeah, one of the things we're doing right now, we're pushing the VVC, the VA Video Connect, for cancellations. When a veteran has a cancellation, they have life issues. They're at school, they're at work, they have family, things come up. But if they're going to cancel the appointment within 48 hours of their actual face-to-face appointment, our call centers will offer them the ability to switch that appointment from a face-to-face to a virtual visit.
At that same time,
though? At that same time, yes.
Okay. Our guests on The Confluence are Dr. Jason Fay, Dave White, and Bill Frazier from Pittsburgh's VA office. We're talking about connected virtual care for area veterans. My Healthy Vet is part of Connected Care. Briefly, what services does this include in addition to appointment scheduling and refilling prescriptions? Bill, then Dave.
Well, one of the most popular features is secure messaging. It offers an encrypted communication with the provider and the care team.
What might that messaging involve, though?
So traditionally, communication between the provider and the patient would be at the time of the appointment. This allows a continuation if the veteran has some questions or they have some concerns, and it creates an ongoing dialogue with the patient and the provider.
Mm-hmm. Dave?
In addition to secure messaging, we got a whole array of features with My Healthy Vet.
Such as?
They can go on and they can order the prescriptions, track the delivery right to the door.
All right.
They can go across and search their health file. They have access to a little more than 90% of their electronic health file, labs, tests, MRIs, x-rays. The imaging came on board last year.
So they can search their personal medical records. To any of you, is that a concern that these records could be hacked, though?
So there's two things you have to do to have a My Healthy Vet account. One, you have to sign up for it, but the second and most important is you have to verify or authenticate your in-person account. So nobody should be accessing it unless, only you.
Mm-hmm. But is there the possibility of hacking for some reason? You know, they're always trying to get information on somebody, these hackers. Is there a concern about that? What precautions do you take?
Well, one of the concerns we have is definitely the patient's private information, their PHI, their health information, and their identifiable information. We do go to great extents to make sure that is confidential. So we have a process, authentication process, to make sure patients sign up and we verify who they are.
Mm-hmm. Right, Dave?
And they also have the opportunity, if they wish, to change their password as well as their security questions whenever they deem necessary as well. And all the messages we talked about, our secure message, that is all encrypted messaging. By them having a unique ID and password, that's encrypting and decrypting the messages for them.
So how does it work, My Healthy Vet, about say you're a Pittsburgh area vet, but you're out of town. You're even out of the country. How does it work?
Oh, we've got patients out of the country. I mean, it's amazing. We have folks over in the Philippines, for example, that the expatriates, and they come back home once in a while to Pittsburgh to receive care once or twice a year. But while they're over there, anywhere you have internet service, you can do it on your phone, you can do it on your iPad, your computer, you can access your MyHealthyVet account.
Yeah, Bill.
There was a recent occasion where we had a veteran, a U.S. Navy veteran, who lives in North Africa, and she was back in Pittsburgh for her appointments, and she had some tests done, and she was concerned about what the results would be, but she had to take her flight back home, and it was just wonderful for her to be able to access her information, her results, communicate with her provider. Everything was fine, but just having that access anywhere in the world and the continuation of the care wherever you are is a great service to our veterans.
Dr. Fay?
Yeah, the only other thing that I would add is that secure messaging is really an avenue to also ask questions to your provider or to give them symptoms in an email and say, you know, what should I do? Should I not come in? Should I come in? Coming into the VA is not always easy. There's parking challenges and there's a lot of people there and you have to take time off from work. But many times you can get questions answered. You can get prescriptions refilled or ordered through an email versus having to come in for care.
All right. So we all know that Southwestern Pennsylvania is blessed with a large veterans population. How many eligible veterans are taking advantage of this? How many are participating in the My Healthy Vet program?
Approximately 39,000 veterans in this area have access to electronic medical records through MyHealthyVet.
Yeah, what sort of percentage, though, is that?
That's about a third.
Yeah, it's about 40%. Yeah.
So is that disappointing that, you know, you're obviously pleased with the possibilities of these services, but is that disappointing that only maybe a third of the veterans are taking advantage?
It continues to grow.
All right.
And that's what we're really excited about. It has continued to grow every year.
And so how many years has this been involved?
Just over 15.
All right. But so what are you trying to make that grow? How are you trying to engage more people, more veterans, to let them know, hey, this is available in case you didn't know?
We're doing more active work with our clinics actually in-house, but the best is word of mouth. Like myself, since coming on board with the VA a little over 3 years ago, I turned my care completely over to VA. And now working with My Healthy Vet, we're getting out to the veteran service organizations, and word of mouth vet the vet tends to be our absolute best marketing.
For broader numbers, though, I mean, word of mouth, yes, vet to vet would seem to be, you know, the most trustworthy, if you would. But are there, you know, widespread public service campaigns, anything like that? Can you advertise?
Yes, we do on our Facebook, for example.
Right.
We do a whole lot of town halls. We talk about My Healthy Vet. Anything to do with the VA, we're trying to throw out My Healthy Vet as well. And it's not just here in Pittsburgh. We try to do it on a visit as well as a national level. But I tell you what, the biggest thing is the comfortability. When the vet tells a vet or providers are starting to bring the veterans to our office, they see the tools that are available to them, how it benefits them. That warm handoff, if you will. That does wonders. Those are the folks that stick around. Once they use it, they're hooked.
Go ahead.
We're also working in concert with our community-based outpatient clinics that we have spread throughout the area, such as Beaver, or Rochester, Washington, Fayette, and others. And we work with them closely to make sure that those veterans in the rural communities are also know about My Healthy Vet and get the opportunity to use it.
We are talking with Bill Frazier, Dave White, and Dr. Jason Fay from Pittsburgh's VA office. The Connected Care program as a whole also involves telehealth. What care can actually be delivered no matter where the veteran is via telehealth?
So there's a couple of different options with telehealth. One is that the veteran would go to a VA facility, so they can go to a CBOC and talk to their provider at the main campus. Another one is they can, VA Video Connect, they could do it from anywhere. They could do it from the comfort of their home. They could do it from the parking lot, from school. So there's two different modalities that can deliver the care. And right now, at least up to this point, the primary focus has been on behavioral health and has been on primary care. But we're expanding both of these services into specialty care. If you have a post-op visit after a surgery where you don't have to want to drive back to the VA, you could do it from home. They could do a picture. They can look at your wound. They can make sure you're doing okay. And you save yourself a visit.
You mentioned earlier about participation and that you were pleased with some of the older vets, Vietnam War veterans, taking part in this. What about the digital generation veterans? What can you do to get them more involved overall in telehealth?
Well, most folks for the telehealth per se, it's going to be more probably MyHealthyVet coming in. They're the ones that don't really need help with the registration process as far as going on and registering and set up an account. They just come in, they start kicking it out as soon as they hear about it. Boom, boom, boom. We do some outreach with some of the other clinics, and that's pretty much the same. We go into the room, and if do you have an account? They already have it. Now, granted, they're transitioning to the VA now, so when you look at the total population, Vietnam veterans are, you know, more widely served.
Right.
But that is the new population coming in now with the global war on terrorism. And they're a little bit more astute in the computers, and as is the transition is just much smoother.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Fay, I wanted to ask you, so say a veteran has diabetes or high blood pressure, something like that, can they monitor at home? And if so, how did they get the readings, the data to their VA doctors as part of the telehealth program?
Sure. We do quite a number of different diagnoses that we follow. Some of the more common ones are diabetes, heart failure, COPD, hypertension. All of those can be monitored remotely from home. We give the veteran equipment. The equipment goes home. They either upload it from a device like their blood sugar or their pulse ox or their weight. They have scales that will communicate. That information is transmitted back. And actually, I believe we use cellular service, not a hardwired port or data. To transmit the data. Data goes back to the medical record. We have a team of nurses that review that data on a regular basis. And if there's any cause for concern, they reach out.
So is the onus on the veteran to, after taking those readings with the equipment provided, to get that info to the healthcare providers? Do they have to take the next step?
Yep. No, most of the time, all the equipment is wirelessly synced to a home base unit that then transmits it up. So all the veteran has to do is just take their blood sugar, take their weight, and then the weight will be transmitted back.
So it automatically goes once they take that, it's 140 over 80 or whatever, the blood pressure.
That's correct.
In our remaining time, we have just about a minute or so. What are your next steps? What are your next hopes for developments that might be in the works to improve access to quality care for veterans? Mm-hmm. I'll just go right around the room. Bill.
So, of course, a continuation of the expansion of MyHealthyVet, and it is evolving. They're coming up with new processes and new applications for MyHealthyVet, so that is exciting.
Okay. And Dave?
Just looking at the VA Video Connect and looking at some of the numbers, last year, 751, but over 600 already this year. Mm-hmm. So that's a projection of approximately 1,800 veterans taking advantage of Video Connect. So it's going to continue to grow, and that's one of the great things happening at the VA.
You see the growth, but do you have particular goals, though? Do you set goals for participation?
Yes, we do have goals for participation, particularly in MyHealthyVet. Every year we want to increase it another 5 to 7%, and I'm very happy to say that the VA Pittsburgh healthcare system has been exceeding those goals.
And Dr. Fay, whether it's MyHealthyVet or the Connected Care Program itself, what are your hopes for even greater growth in terms of participation, but what services that you can provide to our vets?
So the focus for this year, and directly related to the Mission Act of 2019, is to figure out a way that we can offer all the care that the VA offers remotely or a distance way. So right now, if we can't offer the service at VA Pittsburgh, we would send them to the community provider. But now with the advent of the CBT and VVC, we're looking for opportunities to expand the virtual health care broadly across the Western Pennsylvania.
Dr. Jason Fay is the manager of the VA Pittsburgh Office of Connected Care. Dave White and Bill Frazier are coordinators in the MyHealthyVet program. Thanks to all of you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistants from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.